Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
We did not go to Afghanistan to nation build. And it's the right and the responsibility of the Afghan people alone to decide their future and how they want to run their country.
After nearly 20 years, American troops will be out of Afghanistan by September. That's according to President Biden. Officials at the Pentagon say that day may come even sooner than that. But in any case, the end of the forever war could well have terrible consequences. The return to power of the Taliban. Since April, when the pullout began, the Taliban has captured more than a quarter of Afghanistan's districts. And for anyone in the country who opposes their hardline theocratic rule, this is a terrifying prospect. Among many things, the Taliban is ideologically and unrelentingly opposed to the education of girls. Our staff writer, Sue Halpern, spoke recently with an Afghani educator, Shabana Basij Rasook. She's a founder of the only girls' boarding school in the country, the School of Leadership Afghanistan, and it's home to around 100 girls from all over the country. Shabana herself grew up under Taliban rule, and she's watching their advance very, very carefully.
What's it like in Kabul right now?
If you go around Kabul city, you could get a sense that things are in a way as usual. People are going to work. People are meeting in cafes. People are out and about. But then when you speak with people, there is definitely a great sense of concern for Afghanistan. Even though temporarily the heat is off of Kabul city, people are really worried about what's happening in the districts across Afghanistan. Today I had some remarkable conversations with different young women who told me that they are determined to go to work every day, but will also keep a more traditional outfit in their office just to be safe. I spoke with another woman who said, I see this coming. It's likely that Taliban could disrupt life temporarily here in Kabul, but we're not going to go back to that time. We're going to fight them. And these were just a few conversations I had today.
Wow. Are you noticing any difference between the fact that, you know, for years we've had the United States there as a presence and now they're not there? I mean, is that a palpable change?
Not so much physically. You don't see that, especially not in the city. You know, remember the major U.S. withdrawal happened back in 2014. But I think what is more obvious is, you know, believe it or not, people in Afghanistan are very, very glued into news from Washington, D.C. And that has a lot more impact on how people feel.
So, you know, the other day, Joe Biden gave a speech about Afghanistan, and he basically said, you know, it's not the responsibility of the United States to, you know, deal with the problems internally in Afghanistan, which includes, you know, not really caring or dealing with the fact that the Taliban will at least make a play to take over. So I'm imagining that people there were listening to that speech and wondering, you know, how do they interpret that?
For me personally, it is too soon to really thoughtfully reflect on any of this, but the immediate reactions that I hear around me are one of a sense of abandonment, but also a sense of frustration. How could President Biden, formerly in Congress, say when he voted to arm Mujahideen to fight the Soviet Union? And then you also hear young Afghans who are kind of reflecting on this more inwardly and saying, Look at our own politicians. Why should we be expecting anything from the U.S. when our own politicians are mostly self-serving? So those are also very much conversations that people have, looking inwards and expecting a greater sense of responsibility from Afghan leadership.
Speaking of leadership, your school has the word leadership in it. Can you just describe this venture that you started when you were an undergraduate in the United States? You started a school for girls in Afghanistan while you were a student.
I had just finished my freshman year.
Seriously?
Yeah. I was at the end of my freshman year when I co-founded SOLA.
And what motivated you to do this and to take this on?
I think the shortest answer is that I was then and now and ever will be convinced that Afghanistan will experience a sustainable peace and development when a critical mass of women are educated. But we didn't start SOLA that way. Actually, when I co-founded SOLA back in 2008, the idea behind SOLA was to help young Afghan students get scholarship opportunities to the U.S. and other countries to access quality education outside of Afghanistan. But later on, I was really a lot more concerned about brain drain. A lot of Afghan students rightly didn't want to return to a country where the Taliban insurgency had found a renewed sense of hope, especially with the 2014 U.S. Troops withdrawal from Afghanistan. So instead of sending young Afghans outside of Afghanistan to access quality education, I wanted to bring quality education to Afghanistan, to young people. And only then I realized that I was setting up my country's first and unfortunately still only all-girls boarding school.
Why boarding school?
Oh, it's an amazing question and so important. If I may, do like a broad generalization for a moment about the experience of a young girl living in rural Afghanistan, wanting to go to school. She's lucky if she has her family's permission. That means her father's, her brother's, her grandfather, uncles, and often even male cousins if they live in an extended household. By the time she gets out of the house and before she gets to the closest school, it's very likely that she will experience some form of verbal harassment, reminding her that she should be at home and not out trying to get an education. And in some severe cases, girls have had acid thrown on their faces for wanting to go to school. Let's say she gets to school. It's likely that her school has received a threat letter from the Taliban or another insurgency threatening to burn down the school because it's educating girls. And as her school administration is dealing with that threat, deciding what to do with it, she's lucky if one of or two of her teachers show up to teach that day. It's also likely that she will get rushed to the nearest clinic, if there is one, and a bunch of her classmates because of some sort of poisoning. Another way girls' education is locally contested. And let's say she survives all of this and gets home safely. It's not like her family would want her to prioritize her studying or doing her homework, but rather she has to switch gears and start cooking and cleaning and taking care of younger siblings to prove that she continues to be worthy of being allowed to go to school. Now, mind you, this is a collection of hurdles and obstacles that rural girls face. But now imagine putting this very same girl in a boarding school. Take care of so many of those obstacles.
Talk about what it was like for you to get educated in Afghanistan. I mean, you grew up during the Taliban rule. So what was that like?
Well, education was illegal for girls 20 years ago and a little earlier than that. There were some very brave women and their families who decided to accept the risks to secretly educate girls. And I was one of those incredibly lucky girls to get educated under the Taliban regime at that time. You know, you may have heard of teachers being beheaded when they were discovered by the Taliban to be educating girls. And they were all true. And these brave women and their families knew that to be the risk. Our parents knew that to be the risk, but yet there was that commitment. So a couple of years after the Taliban regime, one of my older sisters, who was old enough that she was required to wear a burqa when she went outside, and my father and my mother finally found a secret school that would educate her. And normally, secret schools wouldn't take that risk because a woman wearing a burqa going in and out of the house every day invited much, much more risk and attention in a way. She had to be accompanied by a male family member, so my parents dressed me up as a boy so that I could be her male family escort going to and from the secret school.
How dangerous was that for you? And did you?
Extremely. I remember this one time when my sister kept changing the streets we were walking more frequently than usual. And then finally just walking into a house that happened to have their garage door open and just closing the door. And I remember her shaking. And as I was asking her, why are we doing this? Why are we stopping here? She asked me to be quiet. And we stood there for at least 15, 20 minutes. And then we walked out. And then I remember her being at home and you know, crying and telling my family, my parents, all of this. And I remember asking my parents not to send us anymore. And
it's okay. How old were you?
I was young, probably 8, 9, and my father would, both of my parents, but I remember my father saying this to us quite repeatedly at that time, that everything we have could be taken away from us. But he would say that if there is one thing that no one, and I mean no one, can take away from us, that is our education, our ability to think for ourselves. 20 years ago, statistically, I didn't exist. There were zero female students in Afghanistan 20 years ago. But look at me today. I am not only a highly educated Afghan woman, I run a school where girls from 28 of the 34 provinces come to Sola, most often because they don't have the opportunity to continue with their education where they live.
What happens if the Taliban actually does take over? What happens to Sola? I mean, I'm assuming that you are thinking about this and having to deal
with this. Oh, I'm thinking about this every day. No doubt. Look, I'm very well aware that, especially at this time, anyone could be listening to this, including Taliban. And, you know, here in Kabul, people say, yes, Taliban have changed. They have changed and they have grown more violent. Taliban claim the opposite, right? They say they have changed and they respect women's rights and girls' education. I hope they can prove it to us.
And are you afraid that the Taliban will take over? I mean, you indicated that you thought that people would resist. Is that really how you're feeling? Is that realistic?
You know, I wish I knew the answer. And there's a lot of uncertainty about the next few months, the next few weeks even. But there's one thing that is for sure. I cannot imagine Kabul being run by Taliban. A city that went from less than 500,000 people in 2000 to nearly 6 million plus people right now. And this comes from someone who lived under a Taliban regime in this very city. I was speaking with a young woman, and she said, yes, sure, the Taliban will kill more of us. The Taliban will kill a lot more of us, but they will never, ever rule over us.
Shabana Basij Rasook is the co-founder of the School of Leadership Afghanistan, and she spoke with staff writer Sue Halpern. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. McDonald's, Burger King, KFC, and so many other fast food franchises are truly emblematic American enterprises, as much as Ford or U.S. Steel. And on any given day, it's estimated that a third of Americans eat some kind of fast food. It's part of our after-school rituals, our workday lunches, our road trips. We know all that, and we've all read about the effect on the national health, too. But what's less known is that fast food is also deeply and unexpectedly intertwined with the struggle for civil rights in this country. Marcia Chatelain, a historian at Georgetown, recently won the Pulitzer Prize for History for her book called Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. And she looks at how McDonald's managed to leverage the social upheaval of the 60s into a permanent foothold in Black communities across the country. And in the decades since, Black franchise owners have navigated the economic promise and the economic pitfalls of that corporate relationship. I spoke with Professor Chatelain earlier this week. Where did you grow up and what was your relationship with McDonald's when you were growing up?
So I grew up in Chicago in the 1980s, and I grew up in a time where it wasn't a big deal if your kids ate McDonald's all the time. We could eat McDonald's after church. I went to McDonald's with my friends. And I think as a kid who grew up without the internet, this is where our social exchanges happened. It was, you know, sharing a giant tray of French fries at McDonald's.
Well, fast forward to your career as a historian. How do you pick this subject of all subjects arrayed in front of you to write about McDonald's and its effect on and its interrelationship with the Black community in the United States?
Well, I think part of it is growing up Black in a big city and having all of these interactions with McDonald's that go beyond having, you know, a hamburger and a milkshake. And I remember going away to college. I went to the University of Missouri in Columbia and meeting other Black students from Kansas City or St. Louis, or, you know, Detroit, and saying, like, how many of you have scholarships that were sponsored by Black McDonald's operators? And a lot of us did. And that was always such a point of curiosity to me, the way that everyone knew what McDonald's was, but you wouldn't know who the franchise owner was, because mm-hmm. that person didn't have this unofficial kind of title in the community. But when you talked to other Black people my age, McDonald's had this other life that was tied to historically Black colleges, that was tied to sports, that was tied to community activities. And for me, you know, this was just a fact of my life. And it wasn't until, you know, I was training to be a historian in graduate school that I thought, this is kind of a strange way of understanding corporate relations in people's everyday life. And that's partly why I wrote this book, to see how we got here and why that is a fundamental problem if we're serious about addressing racial and economic justice.
Now, your research really starts in the 60s, and you argue that the assassination of Dr. King in 68 was a turning point in corporate America's relationship with Black communities. And so how does McDonald's capitalize on that moment, and in what spirit?
Well, after King's assassination, there are all of these questions about what directions the civil rights movement can take. And it's happening at a time of incredible exhaustion on the part of people who had been motivated and moved by King's message at mid-century. And I think that you have this moment where people are saying, maybe it isn't legislation. You know, maybe the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 didn't fundamentally change my life because Black unemployment is still a problem. And so you have people who are saying, our next move is Black capitalism. We need to grow up out of marches and trying to seek integration and beloved community. And the bottom line is business and its capital. And the Nixon administration is incredibly cynical. And they say, okay, how can we try to make a gesture toward Black America that isn't going to challenge segregation, that isn't going to really equalize opportunities? We'll say Black businesses for Black communities. You know, Nixon even says Black power in the most constructive sense of the term.
Right. You know, not in the radical term
or the good term, right? And, you know, for McDonald's part, McDonald's is successful because they know when to shapeshift. They're seeing communities change demographically, and they're seeing white franchise owners who no longer want to do business in Black communities. And they're saying, okay, we'll open the door to Black people to franchise restaurants in Black communities and see what happens. And it was incredibly successful. And so they kept on investing in that strategy under the guise of participating in the new civil rights.
I was really struck by the way you trace the history of the relationship between McDonald's corporate headquarters and the National Black McDonald's Operators Association. Describe what the NBMOA is and its fleeting but interesting and starring role in a part of American history.
So this is an incredible group that forms in the early 70s, and they represent the cohort of the first Black men, and they were all men, who had the opportunity to franchise a McDonald's. And these men are from very different places. And these guys are all, you know, kind of brought together by the fact that they are pillars of the community as Black business owners. They're incredibly generous with philanthropy, and they're getting the short end of the stick with McDonald's because they're often doing business in places that have a lot of high crime, broken equipment. And so they kind of come together and they try to advocate with McDonald's to say, you know, we're actually doing really well and our sales are really high, but you're not advertising in the publications and on the radio stations and TV stations that our customers are tuned into. You are not attentive to our need. So it's a strange kind of world that if you comply with the rules, you could make lots of money and you could still comply with all the rules and lose a lot of money. And this is part of the grievance that has long been part of the Black franchisee experience, that they are at a double disadvantage in a system where, you know, there's a lot of risk.
Right. You mention advertising and you devote an entire chapter, in fact, to the ways McDonald's has marketed to the Black community over time. What were the messages these campaigns were trying to send? And which do you remember most vividly? The Calvin commercial seems especially important to you.
So Calvin is an icon.
Hey, isn't that Calvin?
I haven't seen him for a while. Wonder where he's heading.
The setup is it's the early 90s and it's New York City, and you get this stereotypical representation of African-American young men on the block. They're not doing anything. They're loitering. And Calvin is bopping around the neighborhood and you think, ooh, is he bad as well?
Now that you mention it, there is something different about him.
But uh-oh, here's a surprise.
Looks like responsibility's been good for him.
Well, I'm just glad somebody believed in him enough to give him a chance.
Calvin is actually on his way to work, and he flips his hat and he says, "Welcome to McDonald's. How can I help you?"
Welcome to McDonald's. May I help you?
It was a multi-commercial campaign, and you follow Calvin as he gains more responsibility and people start to appreciate and look up to Calvin because he's working hard at McDonald's with the aspiration of one day becoming a franchise owner. So the thing that I found fascinating when I looked at the ads, you know, going back to the 1970s, is that a number of the ads that are targeting Black consumers for McDonald's don't talk about food. They talk about how McDonald's has economically empowered Black people.
Well, right. You make this interesting point that McDonald's often shows up in moments of cultural crisis in the country, especially racial conflict, like the 92 riots in LA. How did the company help create the blueprint for quote unquote disaster capitalism in Black communities?
The animating event that brought McDonald's into Black communities was King's assassination. And it grew out of this sense that if McDonald's could be the anchoring institution for communities in crisis, then it is proving itself to be more than just a restaurant in Black people's lives. And so after the LA uprising, McDonald's issued a press release that said, you know, none of our restaurants were damaged in South Los Angeles. And this is proof that our social investments in the late 1960s paid off. And I thought, wow, this is a wildly inappropriate thing to say. I don't think it's entirely true. But what I found fascinating is that people believed it. And they said, see, it's because McDonald's has been in our community. They've been giving us opportunities. And then when Ferguson happened, and that Ferguson McDonald's on Florissant Avenue, which is franchised by an African-American, you know, became kind of the epicenter of where people gathered during this crisis, I thought, this is really strange. But I think the idea that McDonald's is proximate or special to Black America is both problematic and strangely true all at the same time. It is about more than just food. It's about nostalgia. It's about emotion. It's about belonging. And so the reason why I think this is important is because when we hear all the chatter about health and obesity and race and food deserts, and we often reduce it to personal choices, or we suggest that it's because people don't know better about nutrition, it is very easy for us to dismiss why McDonald's might be important to someone. But from the perspective of 1970, when you think about the fact that Black people can't legally be everywhere they want to be in a public accommodation until 64, having a McDonald's in your community is a big deal. It does matter. And I think that those relationships have continued throughout the generations, even as McDonald's has been exposed as a creator of a lot of problems. I think in some communities, McDonald's has been seen as an entity to solve a lot of problems as well.
Your book is deeply nuanced. Now, I don't want you to be reductive, except can you be? When you look at McDonald's now, how do you think about the question of whether McDonald's has done more harm than good for Black communities? Is that even the right question to ask?
I get asked this question, versions of this question often, and all I can say is this. Capitalism starves people and never feeds them. That's the full stop. And I really wanted to...
Well, let's pause on that. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that anytime we look to the marketplace, anytime we think that if we open up the pathways to enjoy the fruits of capitalism, someone and something gets left behind that is more critically important. And so when I think about McDonald's and Black America, I am concerned about how much McDonald's is paying people and the conditions in which people have to work. I'm concerned about the impact of this massive supply chain on the environment. And I'm concerned about people's health and well-being. And I think more importantly, I'm concerned that in moments in which Black people are crying out for freedom, for justice, for an ability to create stable communities, what they're offered is, let's open a business, or how about a franchise? But I want to be very clear. For all my critiques of fast food, I have a great deal of gratitude for all the people who have fed me through this portal called fast food. I ate a lot of fast food meals growing up and through my PhD program in my early adulthood. And I think I came to a deep appreciation for the high level of skill that is required to feed a lot of people in a short period of time. And so if one day McDonald's says, you know what, we're going to do this a little differently, and we're going to use our influence in order to upend, poverty wages and the problem of work, then I think we get closer to this ideal that we are no longer going to allow corporations to have this incredible role in vulnerable communities, and we are just going to have a restart on how we imagine the quality of American life. A girl can dream.
That's Dr. Marcia Chatelain. She's professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University, and her book is called Franchise: The Golden Arches in Black America, and it won the Pulitzer Prize for History this year. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and I'm at home where I've been with far too few breaks for the past 16 months. I record the show from home, have my meetings at home, edit pieces at home, make calls, catch up on reading. Home, home, home. You know the drill. It's a lot of being at home is what I'm saying.
Hello.
Here we are. I haven't seen you in so long.
I know. I didn't expect our reunion to be at my apartment, but why not?
Come here, you.
It's good to see you. Sorry for the schlep up the stairs.
So it was truly a joy the other day to go visit with a couple of writers from the magazine for that, you know, wonderful sacrament, the late afternoon cocktail. And we gathered on the roof of Michael Shulman's apartment.
We're going to go upstairs and drink. It's a good way to reconvene.
Along with Helen Rosner.
Oh, hi.
The barkeep. How are you?
It's good to see you.
It's been too long.
Helen writes about food and drink for The New Yorker, so she's professionally qualified to tell us exactly what we should be drinking to toast our reopening world. So I'm on Michael Shulman's rooftop, my good colleague Michael Shulman, who writes about theater and the movies and so much else. And Helen Rosner has brought so much drink and drink equipment. I'm trembling with excitement, and it is also about 175 degrees up here. I think if you took a brisket and put it on this table and came back in the morning, you'd have barbecue.
Yes.
But we're not going to do that. We're going to make drinks, or at least Helen is, and all with the goal of getting us through the summer. Helen, what's the first drink you want to make for us?
So somehow the drink of the summer has become, for like the last couple of years, the Aperol Spritz. And you see them everywhere, like every cafe in the West Village, everywhere. The tables are full of these globe-like glasses full of this neon orange liquid, and people are drinking them, and they think they're happy, but they're not, because Aperol spritzes are actually terrible. I don't want to yuck anybody's yum, but I think you can do way better with the European bitter aperitif spritz, right, than you can with Aperol. And you can use pretty much any of the sort of weird aperitif-y things you find at the liquor store, but one of my very favorites is this one. It's called Cynar. C-Y-N-A-R, which is...
I gotta say, it's the nastiest looking label I've ever seen. It's got a big old artichoke on it. It can't be made of artichoke, can it?
It is an artichoke liquor. It's what you want all of your alcohol to be made out of, right? It's like fermented artichoke.
If you say it should be, I'm all ears.
Here, smell it. It doesn't really taste like artichokes. It has a vibe, but...
Ooh. I just took a big sniff and... Woo is what I have to
say. It's herbaceous. It's just like Aperol. It's a little sweet. It's... a little bitter. It's got a lot of sort of edge of medicinal herbs to it, but it doesn't have that cloying, sticky cough syrup
it's
vibe.
It's a little doctor's office circa 1935.
Yeah, a little bit. So I think we should make a spritz, a Cynar spritz. So to do that, we're going to fill a glass with ice.
All right. Give me your glass, Michael. My hands are... I've just been on the subway briefly, so they're similar to clean.
I like a hint of subway in my cocktail. That's fine.
It's for you.
Thank you.
And we put in a glug of Cynar.
Like just a glug.
A glug, an ounce. Okay. It depends on the size of your glass. It depends how much booze you want, how much flavor. The classic spritz, you then top it with some sparkling wine. So we're using a sparkling wine that I really like. It's a rosé. It's from a winery in California called Une Femme, which is all female winemakers, and the wines are glorious and feminist and incredibly delicious. And this is one of their sort of single serving bottles called the Cali. But you could use literally any sparkling wine, Cava, Prosecco, whatever you want. Top the liqueur with that.
This is an especially teeny weeny bottle of...
Isn't this cute?
Rosé champagne. It looks like a tiny Pepsi bottle.
And then on top of that, to lighten it just a little bit, a splash of club soda or seltzer. And should we put in a garnish? I feel like we should.
Absolutely.
Garnish. I like a savory drink. So if you were going to do an Aperol spritz, you'd probably garnish this with a lemon or an orange, but I'm going to pop in two olives and just a little brine for the hell of it.
Here we go. All right, here we go. Love it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
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 Oh, wait, you feel
yeah. That. Delish, Michael.
Mmm. Tastes like summer.
There are no ads on public radio, Michael. I just thought I'd mention that.
I'm in with Big Cynar, so yeah. They pay me to say things like that. But that is very refreshing.
Michael, hold it up right by Cynar. It's delicious.
Your summer starts now.
Yeah. There you go. You'll be on a first class flight to
Rome
tomorrow.
Good.
So I know nothing about this subject,
yeah.
But I drink Negronis. I don't even know what's in it. What's that? And it's not crazily dissimilar.
Yeah, no, actually, when I make Negronis, I actually use Chinar. So a Negroni is like a classic 1-1-1 drink. It's equal parts of all the ingredients. So it's Campari, which I sub Chinar for, gin, and vermouth. So it's just even ratio of all those three.
So things. Campari, which I'm pretty convinced is cough syrup.
Yeah, you don't have to use it. You can use the Chinar.
I don't want you to get under the impression that I make a Negroni.
No. You don't make your own Negronis?
You have to understand, I grew up in a house where the quote-unquote liquor cabinet, when I was growing up, here's what was in the liquor cabinet. 6 big bottles of Hoffman's ginger ale and a bottle of something called cherry herring that my mother once a year would say, you know what? I'd like a drink.
Do you know how to pour liquid from a bottle into a cup?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, so do you think you could do that 3 times with 3 different liquids and then pour it into a bigger vessel?
I feel at some level you're not being kind to me, but yeah.
I feel like I think you could do that. I think, I believe in you, I believe in your spirit. I think you could make your own Negroni.
Helen, what have you got for us next?
Pretty much all I have been into drinking this summer has been like, I just want like really crispy beer, like lagers. But I also have a lot of friends who are cutting back on their drinking or who don't drink, and sometimes I don't want to get buzzed. So I've become something of a connoisseur of non-alcoholic beers, and I have become completely converted to the school of thought that the very best thing you can do with non-alcoholic beer, which is not always great, is use it for a beer cocktail.
Where you're putting also non-alcoholic ingredients.
Yeah, yeah. So we're going to use non-alcoholic beer. We're going to make a Michelada, which is the classic, in my opinion, the classic right. beer cocktail. So Michelada belongs to the grand Mexican tradition of cervezas preparadas, beer with stuff in it. And your basic Michelada, like your basic components, I mean, there's a million variations, but you're going to want hot sauce.
I just want to say you did not spare the hot sauce, and God bless you. Some lime, you want me to get you a lime? All right. Lime is the green one, right?
Okay. Could you, do you think you could handle cutting this lime across the equator
for
me?
I can do that.
So we're going to squeeze in the lime in this juicer.
And then what's this spice that you're going to put in there?
This is great. And I should have actually, normally if I had my stuff together, I would have rimmed the glass, so, you know, wet the edge of the glass and poured some of this out on a plate and then made, like, a nice spicy rim. So this is called Stardust, and it's from Rancho Gordo,
right.
The bean guys. And it's their version of a very, very popular blend called Tajin, which you'll find everywhere. It's smoky and deep, and it's got that kind of tanginess from the lime. So it's a chili, lime, salt blend, and I'm going to add a pinch of that. And then we'll pour in the secret ingredient, Clamato.
Cape Cod in a bottle.
Yes.
So tomato juice with a little clam juice to kind of take the red out of it.
And it adds like a backbone to this beer cocktail that we're making. And then I'll pop open a can of this. It's from Athletic Brewing Company. It's their Upside Dawn Golden Ale. I guess it's a good one.
Does that count as an ad?
In my opinion... With no institutional affiliation, I think this is the best of the non-alcoholic beers that I've tried. Taste that.
Michael, I say this with love. You go first.
Okay.
Okay, here you go.
Oh my gosh. That's got a punch.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. It's very cocktail sauce. It's beer meets cocktail sauce in kind of a good way. Wow! Wow!
Yeah, there's definitely hot sauce in there.
Helen, that was pretty delicious. How are you going to top that with another one?
I think we should make a piña colada.
I agree. I'm putty in your hands.
It's really hot on this roof.
It's very hot on this roof, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get out of this chair either. So what better than a bunch of rum and fruit and God knows what else goes into a pina colada?
It's really simple. Actually, it's a 3-ingredient drink. It has this foofy reputation, but okay. So your classic pina colada is pineapple juice. That's the colada in pina colada. Colada means strained, so pineapple juice. So we're going to deviate from that a little bit. This is going to be our one adaptation. We're going to use fresh pineapple.
Yeah, you made a supermarket stop. We have beautiful fresh pineapple here.
Yeah. Here, I'm going to hand you the blender.
Okay.
The blender vessel. Okay, fill in ice. As much
ice as...
Here's
some ice. Got it.
Okay, I'm going to throw in some pieces. Just, and, like, you don't even have to cut up the pineapple because it's going to be blended.
Right.
Okay, so we did our nod to, like, freshness and real fruit. Instead of using canned pineapple juice, we used real pineapple. But we're going to go absolutely the other direction with the coconut. And we are going to use...
Coco Goya, cream of coconut, the real stuff, not so real, but with lots of extra sugar added, I hope.
So this is like, it's actual coconut milk, but it's like 50% sugar, right? They add just so much sugar to this, the texture becomes almost like custard. It's like condensed milk, but coconut.
Sounds delicious.
And then the rum. Let's just dump in some rum.
Rum, we got some Havana Club.
Yeah, so this is it's a Puerto Rican cocktail, and we're using Cuban rum.
Cuban rum, it's the real Magilla from Cuba.
Yeah.
And there was a time you'd get arrested for that, but not anymore.
But I feel like, you know, one of the most important deals with cocktails is you've just got to use the bottle that you have. I'm going to throw in some more pineapple. You know, the crazy thing about pineapple is, like, it's so, enzymatic. People, like, you can use it as a meat tenderizer. Enzymatic.
So lots of enzymes,
you can use it as a meat tenderizer. If you have, you can use pineapple juice. It digests you back. Like, if you eat pineapple, it's so acidic and so... It's just a race to who can digest who first.
That sounds really gross.
Can I unhear that somehow? It's disgusting.
It's like it's brushing your teeth for you. That's the best spin I can put on that.
Okay.
All right,
let's go blend.
Let's go blend. I'll do the blending. Should I do the blend?
All right.
Michael?
Wait, oh, hold on. Before you drink, I brought... So traditionally, we would throw some maraschino cherries on this, but in my philosophy of use what you've got, I don't have any maraschino cherries, but I do have these, which are...
Little umbrellas!
Yeah.
It is now officially a party, and it's summer.
Oh, that is so incredibly good.
Michael, the look of happiness on your face is not
so
to be
happy.
Described.
Can you come back?
Well, Helen, I have to say, it's the highlight of my year and a half to see you guys, and it's the highlight of my summer to have this drink out on these four drinks out on this rooftop that I don't know that I'm going to be leaving very soon. I think, basically, I'm staying here for hours.
Yeah, no, stay.
We got enough booze to carry us
for a
while.
Let's just have the magazine here.
let's toast to our bartender.
Thank you, Helen.
Thank you, Helen. Thank you. Helen Rosner and Michael Shulman, both staff writers for The New Yorker. Now, speaking of toasts, we're celebrating another milestone. You and I, right now, our 300th episode of The New Yorker Radio Hour. And whether you've been listening since October of 2015, or you've just tuned in for the first time, thank you. I hope you've enjoyed listening to the program as much as we've enjoyed making it for you. L'chaim.
Wait, I'm sorry, David.
L'chaim. Nazdarov.
L'chaim.
Yeah.
That sounded great, David. Give us just 1 second.
Happy 300th, David.
Happy 300th.
And to you.
Right. Oh, happy 300th.
300th.
Wow.
Happy 300th.
Wow.
Since it's the 300th episode, there's something that we actually wanted to play for you.
Oh, no. What
no,
is
not
it?
Embarrassing.
You're gonna be,
not embarrassing.
You're going to be fine,
okay.
I think.
Okay. Thanks for joining us for this, our very first episode of the New Yorker Radio Hour. Welcome to an experiment. Each week we're going to bring you stories, profiles, and humor, all of it inspired somehow by the New Yorker magazine. And it will all come from the writers, artists, and editors who work here at our offices at One World Trade Center. This won't be a mere audio version of the magazine or the website. It will be its own thing, alive to the possibilities of the medium. Starting the magazine in 1925 was an adventure of discovery. We hope this will be too. Ah, who is that clunk?
So if I were to ask you one thing that you've learned?
Yes.
After 300 episodes?
Speak more slowly. Act like you're not reading. And listen to what my colleagues tell me to do. Here's to another 300.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
all of us on the staff of the Radio Hour wanted to take this opportunity, since it is our 300th episode, to say a special thank you to some of the people.
So many people.
Who help make the show possible every week. So, thanks to our consulting editor, Allison McAdam, for all her insights.
To Sean Lavery, Fergus McIntosh, Nima Jeromi, Yasmin Al-Sayed, Alain Werner, and all the phenomenal fact checkers at The New Yorker who keep us accurate.
Fabio Bertoni, Ivan Zimmerman, Jana Fried, and Celia Muller provide only the wisest counsel.
Melissa LaCase and Alicia Allen handle distribution of the program.
Our art director is Sebit Min. A lot of the beautiful illustrations you see on our website were made by Golden Cosmos.
Carlo Blumenkrantz, Nathan Burstein, Willing Davidson, Yamal Ian Scott, Henry Finder, David Haglund, Laylee Kleinbard, Susan Morrison, Monica Rasick,
David Rode, Marath Thomas, Nick Troutwine, Dorothy Wickenden, and Daniel Zaleski are a few, and we really mean just a few, of the New Yorker editors who lend us advice and support.
Natalie Raby, Karen Quinn, Jennifer Houlihan-Roussel, Jasan Collins, and all their teams help spread the word about what's on the show.
David Satkowski, Rob Christensen, and the others at NYPR's engineering team keep us up and running.
Bruce Dionis makes sure things don't fall apart at The Office. Remember The Office?
Aww.
Rebecca Weiss handles your comments, good, bad, and ugly.
Mengfei Chen, Julia Rothschild, and Alexander Barish support the show in so many ways, as do Sarah Sandbach and David Gable.
Paul Thomason does our final air check.
Meryl Garbus of TuneYards wrote our theme music, and we have additional music from Alexis Quadrado.
Louis Mitchell, our technical director, also writes a lot of the original scoring you hear on the show.
Emily Botine is our vice president, guru, and fairy godmother.
And we wouldn't be here without the support of Goli Sheikhul Islami, Andrew Golis, Deirdre Foley Mendelson, and above all, David Remnick.
Let's never forget.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Sharina Endowment Fund.